Hey, this is Coach Hines with your Monday kickoff thought. So a while back, I had a player come to me during the season and vent a little bit about a coach that he felt was playing favorites. And I heard the young man out. I just listened to him. And then after about 2 or 3 minutes, I looked at him, I smiled, and I said, all coaches play favorites. And he looked at me and he goes, you don't? And he was adamant about it. And I was like, I do. He's like, no, you don't. Almost arguing with me. And I looked at him. I said, listen, all coaches play favorites. I play the guys that work the hardest, that grind, that go out of their way to empower their teammates, that show up to not just the mandatory practices and workouts, but that show up to the optional workouts, that go above and beyond. And he's like, well, I get that. And I said, listen, we all want to win. But we want to do it with the right guys. So if you want to be coach's favorites or one of his favorites, go out of your way to do those things. Be academically eligible all the time. Be someone that we never hear of from teachers or administration unless it's in a positive way. You know, life is full of who you know, people making connections with other people and building upon those connections. And that's one of the most valuable things I think we can teach as coaches in football, whatever sport we coach, is that people play favorites. But usually being someone's favorite is completely within our control. It's the people that show up, that go above and beyond, that look to empower others. So instead of complaining, or the next time you hear someone complaining about people who play favorites, let's try to empower them to go out of their way to be someone's favorite. But for all the right reasons. Take it for what it's worth. Stay strong.
Welcome to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast, where top football coaches from around the country share their stories, philosophies, concepts, and strategies to help you get better on and off the field. Now, here's your host, Keith Grabowski.
Welcome to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast. I'm excited to be joined today by Tom McDaniels. He's an Ohio coaching legend here. Is in the Ohio High School Coaches Hall of Fame. He had a 40-year career. His team at Camp McKinley in 1997 was the state champ and won a national title, and he was named National High School Football Coach of the Year as well. I'm excited to have him here because I remember sitting in his clinics back when I was growing up as a coach, and most of you probably know his sons, and you've heard of them, Josh McDaniels, who's the offensive coordinator for the Patriots, and Ben McDaniels, who works with the Michigan Wolverines right now. Well, Coach, it's incredible to have you here. I'm excited to be talking ball with you today.
No, I look forward to it. I'd get up in the middle of the night to talk football with you.
Well, Coach, I know all about your career here in Ohio, but for those of you, I guess, who aren't familiar with what you've done here, I just want to dig kind of into your background a little bit and talk about, you know, those days as a young coach and developing as a young coach and thinking back to it. What was it that made you want to be a coach and got you started in this profession?
Well, I had a great high school experience as a football player, and I'm not talking about, you know, games played, because I was just a very average at best football player, but I played for, you know, two guys who were in the Ohio High School Football Coaches Hall of Fame, Bill Schunkweiler and Mo Tipton. And they had good assistant coaches, and those people made a significant impact on my life. And I knew relatively early in my life that I wanted to do what they did. They were inspirational. They were motivational. They were hardworking. And you know, they left an unforgettable impression upon me. So, right after my senior year of high school, a classmate of mine, we adopted a young baseball team. I believe the kids were maybe 12 to 14 years old. It was a local league in Orville, Ohio, and we coached those kids for two seasons until they were old enough to be out of that league and moved on to the next one. But the second year we won, you know, we're undefeated, and you know, that whole experience just you know, whetted my appetite all over again. That wasn't the sport I wanted to coach, but it was coaching, and we didn't even have a youth football program at that time in Orville. But you know, that if there were any doubts or any, you know, second thoughts about going into coaching, I think that that experience, you know, changed that for me forever. And so I knew early I wanted to coach and followed through on it. And I can thank those gentlemen and the assistance they had for pointing me in the right direction.
Coach, as you look back on the beginnings of your career and some of those key developmental moments, what were the lessons that you learned that really made a difference and became part of who you were as a coach?
I was an assistant for 10 years before I became a head coach. And I worked for, you know, Mo Tipton at Oroville, Keith Wakefield, who's now at Perry and was at Mansfield Madison. He's in the Ohio High School Coaches Hall of Fame. And Terry Forbes for 2 years at Camp McKinley before I became the head coach. And, you know, Mo had me those first several years. And other than contributing an awful lot of enthusiasm, I don't know that I contributed a whole lot more than that. But I soaked up, you know, what I saw. I listened, I absorbed a lot from them. I mentioned this the other day to somebody that as a first year coach, when we went to clinics, Mo had me attend every session possible. I had to take extensive notes, and then I had to write summaries of those presentations and make copies for the other assistant coaches who weren't necessarily, you know, attending those clinic meetings and those sessions. They were, you know, socializing in the lobby or whatever it was that they were doing. But that was a discipline that he put on me that actually helped me because it exposed me to people that I didn't know and to thoughts and concepts and ideas that I wasn't aware of. And then having to take notes and then rewrite them and then, you know, make them make sense to the coaches, you know, that sort of solidified, you know, whatever learning experience the clinic itself was for me, but having to, you know, to repeat that stuff back to other people so that it was understandable. I think that was a key thing, and I'll forever be grateful to Mo, you know, for making me do that as a first year coach. I also know that later on when I was a head coach, you know, I had more freedom to go to spring ball or bowl practice or whatever. And I went to clinics that the other guys just couldn't get to because, you know, they didn't have the ability to leave school like I did. But I did the same thing. I would write up notes and, you know, from great presentations and share them with the coaches. So, you know, that was a very positive experience, a very, very good thing for me to have to do as a young coach. And I'm forever grateful for that. I worked for Keith Wakefield, who is as good a Wing T high school football coach as I've ever encountered. I worked for him in Mansfield Madison, and you know, Keith was a Wing T savant, still is today. Mm-hmm. I learned more about that offense, and you know, the most significant thing I learned is that there's a whole lot of other offenses that you know have adopted Wing T concepts. You know, and sometimes I think some of the young guys today don't even know that those were Wing T concepts. But the Wing T, you know, by itself has found its way into, you know, the eye formation, you know, the offset eye, some of the one back power stuff. I mean, it's, you know, it's all Wing T based, you know, at least in my eyes. But that whole experience, you know, with Keith was extremely helpful to me. And then when I coached for Terry, the first 2 years that I was here, I was a quarterback receiver coach. But it was that point in time in my life where I knew that, okay, if I had majored in, you know, quarterbacks and receivers, I needed to minor in something. And so I shift my focus to the secondary. And I wanted to try to be as knowledgeable about that position on that side of the ball as I felt like I was as a 10-year assistant coach, you know, relative to quarterbacks and receivers. And then, you know, then once I felt like I had minored in secondary play, I then wanted to have a second minor, and that might be, you know, as I recall, it was the offensive line. And so I had a position responsibility that I felt really good about, but I knew that if I wanted to grow, and that was one of the important things I think that assistants need to do, you know, before they become head coaches, they need to expand, you know, their area of expertise, you know, and I think we all have them. We're like to think that we do, but I think that you need to expand that, you know, to the other side of the ball and to even a position that you've never played and maybe had never coached. But I think that, you know, those three experiences from those guys were hugely helpful to me, you know, when I eventually became a head coach. And I'm a guy, too, that doesn't believe you're ever ready to be a head coach, just like you're never, ever ready to be a parent until you have a child. I think we become ready, but somewhere along the line, you know, those guys impacted me or impressed me, you know, with you know, getting whatever readiness I could have, you know, for that head coaching opportunity. You know, I didn't have to wait for that all to happen after I became a head coach.
Coach, in thinking of that idea of getting ready to become a head coach, I look at a lot of the young coaches out there. Who are hunting titles, maybe not as patient as we used to be. I used to view, I still view the profession as kind of a mentor apprentice type of relationship as you get into it. But I think maybe a lot of young guys, as I see them kind of jump all over looking for that bigger responsibility, have lost that mentorship. How important do you feel that is right now for maybe those young guys to think about a little bit more rather than being so hungry to get to that title, that next position?
Yeah, well, I think it's worth mentioning, you know, in this conversation that you know, the 10 years that I was an assistant before I became a head coach, five of those years I was an unpaid guy. I didn't even have a salary. I was on the staff. I had a responsibility. And that mattered to me more than a stipend. And I don't know if that happens, you know, if that's common now or common back then, but, you know, I wasn't going to let not having a stipend prevent me from learning and growing as a coach. You know, there's a bit of advice that I gave to both my sons, and it made a lot of sense, you know, when I gave it to them. And I think it makes a lot of sense now. I think that coaches need to be great at the job they have to get the job that they want. And, you know, that line's not original with me, but it certainly applies to coaching. And I think that's what their focus should be. If you're part of a staff, then, you know, if you hope at some point, you know, to be a head coach or to you know, be a coordinator, then I think your first objective is to be the best assistant coach on that staff. Or be the best position coach, whatever that position is, in the state of Ohio or whatever state you happen to be in. I think that's where you begin to take steps, you know, toward a job or a position or a title that you may not even anticipate, you know, that you don't even have in mind at the time. And it's just like playing the game. You know, winning and losing is an outcome, but it's all those things that result in the win or result in the loss, you know, that get you the outcome. And so I sort of think of you know, working your way from an entry level assistant to a mid level to a, you know, to a guy that's, you know, thinking about being a head coach. I think you have to approach that the same way. You know, think of, you know, being a head coach or being a coordinator. Maybe that's an outcome, but how do you get to be that? And those are some of the things that I did, and those were some of the suggestions that I made, you know, to my kids about coaching once they got in. It'd be great at the job you have, and if you are, somebody's going to notice, and they're going to want to expand your role, and they follow that, and it's worked for them.
Coach, I know you were very successful in building programs here in Ohio. When you think to, you know, all the different situations you've been in and the things you learned from each one and building a program, people talk now a lot about the culture, right? Building the culture. To you, what were the key things that you needed to get in place and you needed to have buy-in on for your team to be successful?
There were two, and I think I think pretty much, you know, begins and ends with these two things. I was an over the top team concept guy. And sort of breaks my heart in this current era where it seems to me in not just football, but in many sports, especially in high school, where we're over celebrating, you know, the achievements of apparently a pretty good player at the expense of the team. And I never believed in that. You know, I had a clinic topic I presented at New Orleans at the National Clinic one year about team building and about the things that we did at Warren Harding, you know, to get our kids to buy into and to believe in the team concept. Because, you know, like it or not, I don't think that we're, you know, we may be born with genes and some DNA that you know, contributes to speed or size or strength or whatever, but I don't know that we're born unselfish. You know, and my history suggests and strongly tells me that we're not, but I think that you have to cultivate an unselfish attitude, an all for one for all mentality. And you know, you can do that a million ways. And if there's a million and one, then I want to learn, you know, that one that I don't already know. But it was, you know, getting the group to understand, you know, that, you know, we could accomplish so much more together than we ever could by ourselves. And we were so dependent upon each other, you know, for not just individual success, but the team success. That was the one. And then the second thing, and I was at Canton McKinley and Warren Harding and other places where we had great, great football players. Who you know, finished high school and went on, you know, to major colleges, and some even on to the NFL. But I was, you know, I was the guy that believed that you should expect the most from the best. And by saying that, I meant, you know, the most effort from the best players, you know, the most promptness from the best players, the best attendance, you know, in the off season program and summer conditioning and so on and so forth from the best players, the best performances from the best players, the best examples in the building, you know, about being a good citizen from the best players. And it was amazing to me that when we followed through and demanded that from the best guys we had, it was amazing, you know, how everybody else, you know, fell in line. It was amazing how you know, if he's going to demand that from that guy, and be strict and you know, unyielding, and you know, we didn't spoil him, we didn't pamper him. If you were among the best players, then you needed to know that I was going to expect more from you, you know, than some guys who may be less talented. And you know, that helped us to sort of curtail that star player concept. We were never going to be, you know, a program, you know, that celebrated one player, you know, above and beyond the team. You know, we did those kinds of things at the banquet, you know, when they gave out awards. But I think those two things, you know, and they call that culture now, and I understand that that's a popular concept. But back then, you know, that's what it was. We maybe just didn't apply that term to it, but it was about, you know, being a team and expecting the most in every way from our best players. You know, we weren't going to look the other way. You know, we weren't going to, you know, cut them any slack. We were going to be more demanding on our best guys than we were on anybody else. And I think those two things served me well, especially at Kent McKinley and Warren Harding.
Coach, I can think to some of the situations I've been in with that, and I was of a like mind, thinking we had to get the most out of those guys. But sometimes you find that guy maybe who doesn't understand his impact on the team, maybe doesn't understand his potential that we see in him, and is a little bit slower maybe to get on board or to get moving in the right direction. How did you handle that type of guy?
Well, the thing that I think we have to admit to is that a lot of those guys, that was not what they were used to, you know, as they came up through the youth leagues or came up through the middle schools. There were guys in Canton and Warren who were legends before they ever, you know, enrolled in Warren Harding or Canton McKinley High School. you know, they were youth league legends or they were middle school legends, you know, in multiple sports. And what they didn't know was that, you know, during that time of their lives, they were probably extremely successful based on sheer ability alone. You know, I don't know that, and I'm not disrespecting youth league programs or middle school programs, but I don't know that they work nearly as hard, to achieve the success that they might have had, as much as dependent upon, you know, just ability alone. So that was a foreign concept to a lot of those guys. And, you know, whether it was Kenny Peterson or Jamar Martin or Mario Manningham or Maurice Claret, you know, and I can go on and on and on. Those guys were, you know, legends in their communities before they ever, you know, ever enrolled in the high school. And so I think we had to be patient with them at the beginning, you know, as that kind of expectation, you know, smacked them in the face, you know, as freshmen or sophomores in high school. And I knew that, you know, we had to be patient and we had to communicate our purpose, you know, and make it clear to them that this was the expectation that we were going to put on them, you know, and I would do that in a public setting in front of everybody. And I would do that individually behind a closed door, you know, for you to become as good as you have been on ability alone. You know, I need to expect more from you in 100 other ways. And that's something that you need to get comfortable with. That's something that I want you to understand. It's you know, it's not intended to harm you or hurt you or whatever. It's intended to make you better. And if we did that, it elevated everybody. You know, that was sort of the approach that I took, but you know, we couldn't be more patient. We couldn't be too patient because, you know, that transition had to happen quickly. But we were going to be patient in the beginning and we were going to be remindful of the concepts and the things that we expected. And we were going to give them time to adapt and they literally all did.
Coach, you've had a unique opportunity and, you know, having seen your sons grow up in the game, seeing where they're at right now. I'm the son of a high school football coach, and I can remember from, some of my youngest days, just, you know, my free time, I'd be drawing up plays, and I wanted to be a coach, and I wanted to be like Dad. And your sons have gone on to do some great things in coaching. Did you see that developing in them as they were growing up, that they were going to be some great coaches someday?
Well, the introduction to high school football for them was early. You know, when they were five or six, and we actually have a picture of Josh when he's four. You know, I'm assistant at McKinley. He's 4 years old, and he's about 2 feet away from me in a receiver drill. But they got to come to 2-a-days. It gave Mom a break during August, you know, so that. Instead of having three at home, she maybe had one because the two oldest got to come to practice. But being in that environment, being around the older kids, the high school kids in the locker room, being in the coach's office, you know, I don't know that I ever knew while it was happening, you know, that they were processing information or they were absorbing, you know, things that they heard or saw. But I think when I look back, ultimately that's exactly what happened, because by the time they got to organized football, whether it was, you know, middle school or high school, I think because they were around the game at a young age, I think they came into organized football with elevated football IQs. You know, that didn't mean that they were the smartest kid in their class or the smartest kid in the room or you know, the smartest kid in the huddle. But that they had elevated football IQs, and you know, as a coach, you know, I remember hoping that they wanted to play the game and hoping that they loved the game, but they didn't force it on them. Punishment for them back in those days was that if you didn't eat your supper, you weren't going to 2-a-days tomorrow. And it was amazing how quickly that plate got cleaned, or if you didn't make your bed or you didn't pick up your, you know, the family room, whatever that. That was leverage to them, and that was like the worst possible punishment, is that they didn't get to come to 2-a-days, or they, you know, they couldn't come over and watch, you know, after school practice, you know, when grade school was over with. I think just being around the game, I don't know that I can explain that. I just know that they fell in love with the game. Two out of the three are coaches. My oldest boy Jason is works for the Stark County Auditor. But two of the three kids fell in love with the game, and they knew early that they wanted to do what Dad did. They saw me having a lot of fun. They saw the camaraderie I had with my assistant coaches, and I think, whatever Mo Tifton and Bill Schunkweiler did for me, perhaps I and the assistants who worked for me, they did that for my kids, and they grew up wanting to do what we did, and they surpassed it.
Coach, I know that you're still a coach. You don't have a team right now, but you're still as passionate about the game. You're still learning. So you have a tremendous opportunity to learn from two guys who are in the thick of it and two really good organizations. Do those guys come back and teach you some of the game and the things they're learning?
Well, I talk to both of them almost every day. Coach Belichick has been great, and I'm welcome, at Patriot practices all the time. When Josh was a younger assistant, with the Patriots, he'd ask Bill, hey, is it okay if my dad comes to practice? And at some point, Bill told him, he said, "Don't ask me again. He's welcome anytime, anywhere. So you don't have to ask me anymore." And Ben's always been real good that way too, wherever he's been. And he's with Jim Harbaugh. He's coaching the quarterbacks there at Michigan, and I've been at Michigan practices, and they've been great to me. But what our conversations now a lot of times revolve around what I see that they're doing that I might not understand, and so I'll ask for clarity or an explanation. About what it is that they're teaching and what it is that they're doing. And even though I don't have a team to coach, I still like to make sense of what I'm looking at. And I always get a little indication from both of them before games about what I can expect from the opposing defense, because they're both offensive coaches. And so I get a little mini scouting report about what they can expect, and then I watch and I look for that and see how their plan of attack matches what it is that they expected defensively. Every once in a while, we'll have a conversation about handling a situation or handling a player or an issue, but and again, certainly not in terms of evaluating the player, but about maybe how I managed a circumstance or how I managed a situation in my life, and that's just very rarely and just occasional where that's a question that they pose to me. But they're certainly not consulting me about X's and O's information. I'm learning from them.
Well, Coach, I'm gonna stretch back to something I learned from you in the X's and O's. And I
Okay.
mentioned this before we got going, but I sat in a clinic of yours, and I believe it was when you were at Camp McKinley, and I can't exactly remember where that was, if it was at the Cleveland Coaches Association or Ohio, but it was somewhere. And you talked about the naked package, and I learned just a ton from you that day. And I told you I went on to implement some of those ideas that you were talking about later while I was the offensive coordinator at Baldwin Wallace University. So, talk to me a little bit about what you feel makes a really good naked package.
Well, I think that and this is true for any kind of a play action pass concept. The more that the pass play off the run action, the more that it can then that it can appear like the run play, the better off the play is, and the better prospect for success the play has. And I wasn't always a guy that understood that. When early in my coaching life, I started in 72 and through the 70s and 80s, we were a boot team. We were simulating a run to the left, but we were pulling the backside guard, to help protect for the quarterback away from the fake. But that didn't look anything like, the toss sweep or the power play or counter, when we ran those run plays. And at some point in my life, you know, I became aware of the naked concept and what we did, and we did it off of two specific actions, you know, the counter tray run. And I'm not sure if they use that term nowadays, but, you know, it'd be I formation football, maybe an offset fullback. We pulled the, you know, the backside, you know, right guard and right tackle and block down on the left side and, you know, kick out and, you know, pull the tackle through and, you know, the tailback took counter steps, the fullback field for the pulling guard and the tackle. And you know, that counter trade look. And then we were a big toss sweep team, you know, where we reached and pulled uncovered guys and led with the fullback and tossed the ball and got to the perimeter. And when we, you know, we got smart enough to run, you know, play passes with that exact run action. You know, we pulled the backside guard and tackle from right to left and faked the tailback to the left and came naked, you know, out the right side. But you know, to a team that read line keys and read keys real well, that was a better way to execute the, you know, the play action pass. And, you know, we'd fake the toss sweep to the left and you know, we'd reach on the front side and cut off on the backside, pull uncovered guys, but we were going to give the defense, you know, probably 8 or 9 guys out of 11 doing something that very much resembled, you know, toss sweep or very much resembled the counter tray action, you know, right or left. And then I was the guy that knew with running receivers that tried to create triangles for them, you know, on a half of the field, you know, and we read high to low or outside to inside or whatever it was that they were teaching. But those play action concepts very much resembled the run plays. And those, you know, to me were and still are the best ways to run play pass action.
Coach, in the program you worked at Camp McKinley High School, we've had Coach Reardon on here. We had Coach Nate Moore on here just recently in the last year, and those guys talked about that game and the rivalry. But I'd like to get your thoughts on playing in a game like that. I've been to one of them. I was able to go to one. It was at Maslin, and from my perspective, it was just an incredible sports atmosphere, an incredible event. But coaching in that game, what did it mean to you?
So the first one I ever saw, I coached as an assistant in 1980. And I was a kid that grew up in Oroville, Ohio. And when we played Worcester, you know, we thought that was the biggest rivalry in the state of Ohio. And so I come to Camp McKinley in 1980, and I'm part of the McKinley-Maslin game. And I quickly realized that, you know, Oroville-Worcester is a big game, but it didn't quite measure up to this. There's so much history. The game goes back to 1894. You know, the two communities are so close together. I think it's like maybe 14 or 12 miles that separate Maslin from Canton. You know, both schools, you know, have all this history and all this tradition that predated, you know, certainly my arrival, you know, in Canton. And, you know, household names, coaches and players. And you know, back before, you know, we had parochial school domination. You know, it was Maslin and it was Canton McKinley and it was Warren Hardy and it was Niles and you know, great, great public schools that were dominating high school football at that particular time. So I get to be a part of this, and I never witnessed or never seen anything like it in my life. And then the week of the game is unlike any other week. You know, there are luncheons, there are a Fellowship of Christian Athlete breakfasts, you know, the Rotarians and the Kiwanis Club. And, you know, there's this huge pep rally, you know, the day before the game and a bonfire the night before. And, you know, the ride from Canton to Maslin the day of the game, you know, school buses, motorcycle police escorts, running through red lights because the motorcycle, you know, those guys knew what they were doing, and one guy would fly ahead to the next intersection while the remaining 4 or 5 motorcycles stayed with the buses. And then, you know, we'd get to that intersection and that guy'd have the traffic blocked. And then the next guy would go to the next. I mean, it was, It was breathtaking, and I hadn't gotten off the bus in Massillon yet. It was amazing. You know, the stadiums are packed, and you know, we're talking thousands and thousands of people. And I don't want to try to quote capacity at Massillon or Canton, but you know, if they held 20,000, there were 20,000 people there. You know, both communities were so passionate about the game. You know, the losing coach, you know, he made his way through life after that game through the alleys of his community, and the guy who won the game, you know, he was right down Main Street, you know, all winter long. It's not a game that I try to explain to people, because I think it's a game that you have to experience. And I was part of 20 of those games. During, you know, my time as an assistant and then my time here in the 80s and 90s as a head coach, you know, we had the two most successful decades at McKinley in the McKinley-Massillon game ever in the history of the rivalry. And so, you know, I happened to be at the right place at the right time relative to, you know, the McKinley-Massillon rivalry. It was amazing. I can't explain it. It's, you know, there's a documentary called Timeless Rivals. If people want to get an idea about what I'm talking about, Google that. It's called Timeless Rivals. It was, a documentary made about 2 years ago. It does the best job of explaining the McKinley-Massillon rivalry of anything that I've ever seen or heard, and far better than I can explain myself.
Well, Coach, we'll look that up and try to put it in our show notes as well.
That'd be great.
Coach, as you look back on, you know, 40 years of coaching and being able to stay close to the game now, you certainly see all the challenges that our game faces. What advice do you have the coaches right now in order to keep our game strong, in order to keep this profession strong?
One of the concerns, and I don't mean to be an alarmist, but it is something that concerns me, is the focus and the celebration of individual achievement within the great game of football. And I'm talking about individual recognition and celebration of individual achievement in season. Let's get to the banquet at the end of the season, and you can do that at a banquet, behind closed doors, and do honor to, you know, the best players and so on and so forth. But I'm bothered by, you know, the celebration of individual performance in a great, great team game. I'm concerned about the camps that you know, proclaim to be in search of elite players, you know, grade 2 through 8, you know, for $450 on a weekend in the summer. I don't think that that's necessary. I'm not a fan of the national all-star games. I'm not a fan of these all-star 7-on-7 tournaments that they have. I think all of those things are ultimately directed toward just a few players, not the many. And that flies in the face of what I believe about football being a team sport. I think there are a lot of people making an awful lot of money because they know how to market. And I don't think that there's a great return. And I don't know that they're making huge differences in kids' lives. I think high school coaches do that because we have kids over a long period of time, you know, 3 or 4 years, and we spend countless hours with them. And I think that, you know, we need to be reminded that that's our most important responsibility. We've got to impact kids the right way, change their lives, you know, in some instances. But I believe the commercialization of the game is a negative. I don't see that as a good thing. And I'm a guy that still trains quarterbacks. I don't advertise. I get calls from people who ask if I can, and then I do. But I'm also not a guy that's making a ton of money doing it. I don't mind telling you that you know, what I charge is $20, you know, per session. And you know, I'm not getting rich doing that. That's not my intention. I love to do it because it keeps me in the game. But there are a lot of people charging, you know, way, way more than that, and they are in it to make the money. But those are the things that I'm concerned about. And I would hope that I could see you know, those things lessened and those things diminish and go away. I think that would be good for the game.
Coach, to finish up, the question I like to ask of every guest is, you know, looking at all the things you did to build your teams, to get your players ready, to win football games, what's the one thing you would point to in all of that that you would say really gave your team the winning edge?
I think that's pretty simple for me, too. We didn't pursue the outcome, you know, and I mentioned that before to you, that winning and losing is an outcome. But we establish a standard of excellence for the kids of how the game should be played. And we got them to believe in that, got them to embrace that. And it's more detailed than I perhaps have time to explain to you at this particular time. But you know, literally, we would win games, maybe handily, and yet the kids left the field unsatisfied because they hadn't measured up to the expectation that they had had. We didn't play good football. You know, we were big believers in these are the things that you do that they're identified as good football, and these are the things we want to avoid because those things are identified as bad football. So I you know, and Nick Saban talks about it being a process, and a lot of other people do that, you know, other places too, but we really got them to believe that everything that we did, you know, from managing the outcome of the game we just played, win or lose, you know, to arriving at practice the first day of the week and, you know, getting the scouting report and then working our way through the week, we really got them to believe that those things, you know, got us the outcome more often than not that we desired. And I attribute that, you know, and the coaches bought into that and the kids bought into that. And it was amazing how, when we played good football, how many games we won. And you know, how many games we won, you know, maybe we didn't even meet that expectation, but they were dissatisfied themselves without me imposing that on them. You know, when we had great, great teams, that was a concept they embraced, understood. And I think that was as critical to the success that I've been a part of as anything.
Coach, I know you've become active on Twitter, and it's great to see you out there giving some coaching points here and there. What's your Twitter address? Coach, I see that you've been active on Twitter. I love the coaching points that you're putting out there. We'll put your Twitter handle in our show notes as well so coaches can connect with you.
That'd be great. I love to connect with coaches, and the more people that I can hear from and communicate with, you know, the better I'm going to feel about it. So please do that for me.
Coach, you are welcome to come back and talk ball at any time. I love talking ball with you today. And just thank you for all you've done for the game in the past, especially in Ohio here, and I appreciate you as a coach.
Well, Keith, please know that I appreciate what you're doing, you know, because you're representing the game the way that I think it ought to be represented. I hope people, you know, take what they learn, you know, from your podcast or whatever, and emulate it and imitate it and appreciate it, because that's how the game's supposed to be coached.
Check out our new Twitter at FBDEV Coach. We're doing some great stuff there every single day. We're adding to it as we go through the off season here. We want it to be a great resource for coaches out there. Also, check out our systems at footballdevelopment.com if you are looking for some cutting-edge techniques. We put it together in our advanced tackling system as well as our contact system. I also highly recommend you checking out our system for building culture. And we partner with Focus 3 and Brian Kite. And Brian's done a phenomenal job in helping organizations around the country, from corporate America to the education world to teams like Ohio State. If you read the book Above the Line, all of that book was about what Brian and his father Tim did to help out the Buckeyes. You could go get our system at usafootball.com/Focus 3.
Thanks for listening to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast. For more resources, visit the Coach Performance Center at usafootball.com.